Well, I was, when we were talking about archetypes, one of the capacities that we just mentioned, I guess I'm still thinking of archetypes as also, like architect and father or something like that. So I'm kind of a little...
Yeah, it's not pure usage. I know Jung does it. He does it all the time. But then he himself criticizes himself for doing it. You think of them as images, but they're not. It's the capacity for response.
I guess I can't divorce it entirely of content. And it sounds like what you're talking about.
It is divorced.
I guess that's,
Well, you can find plenty of places where he doesn't do it.
Exactly.
You can also find places where he criticizes himself for not doing it.
Was that a later development?
It's just sloppy, I think.
So, okay. I'm feeling just slightly confused from it. So you're saying he doesn't use terms like father archetype?
No, that he contradicts his own standards.
Mm-hmm. So in the purest
pure term,
there is a formless energy. It's energy of potential. And the archetype,
I would say it's the structure of energy.
Well, but right. And the structure is what the archetype forms. Structure that is coming through the term
In other words, we should distinguish between archetype and archetypal image, but we don't.
Right.
We should. He doesn't, but he should.
It's not a structure for a particular archetype, it's just like
a human structure.
Right.
And the not a structure. Right. Because the challenge is that it can show up over time across cultures and military systems.
Right. And the same.
Right. But it carries the same psychic charge.
Exactly. Right.
But it, so you can't always recognize it by saying it always comes in this form.
Right.
But I guess where I got to, because I think, like, for father image, how do we introduce father in a father image? And he's saying, no, it's not even that capacity. It's just a capacity to produce image.
No, I'd say it's the capacity to produce the father.
Okay, well, that helps.
Okay,
well, that helps.
Yeah, because
that helps.
Because you have to be able to recognize it.
Yeah.
And so we recognize it by how the
type of alignment comes
in. Well, that's what I was trying to check with. I thought it was the
same
for
he is not clear. Okay, let's go to page 4 and we'll wrap this up. We're looking at what synchronicity challenges in psychology, and we're looking at what synchronicity challenges in science. And the last point I wanted to make is in the middle of page 4, I think, which kind of sums this all up. Halley writing to Jung, we had basically agreed in the past on the necessity of a further principle of interpretation of nature other than the causal principle. We know there are things going on that are more than causal, but we don't know what that is. But they're saying, let's at least admit it exists.
This is what Mary Kay and I were just talking about at break, because I was telling her that you all know Jim's organic chemist, but I spent a lot of time with scientists, and I was talking to a couple of guys the other day, and I was just talking about some of my experiences and how they inform my life. And they were saying, oh, those are just coincidences or whatever. Well, but here was the point. I said to them, you know, call them what you will, they are powerful and they really inform my life. And they were giving me some examples. And I said, well, just, you know, just pay attention to what happens. Just notice it. And Jim and I were talking about this later, and I was saying, you know, I think this whole thing is going to emerge into consciousness through story, not statistics. It's a feminine energy. And so so for somebody to sit down and try to come up with some experiment and try to show it, as we were talking about, it's not a concept that way. So I think part of what needs to happen is this possibility will take form when enough of us claim the power of it and don't feel threatened in the presence of people that look and say, well, because the scientific model is so strong.
Yeah.
And I think one of the keys to it is the more you live it and you it comes in your own life, the easier it is for you just to stand in the power of it, regardless mm-hmm. of what anybody else does. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the more people that can do that, I think that's how it's going to just more and more and more
osmosis
come into, well, I think it's narrative. It's, yeah, it's in a narrative form. It's not going to be through science.
It's actually coming in through business. One of the ways, have you heard of the law of attraction?
Right.
That's very active in the business community, particularly in the entrepreneurial community,
right.
and in the coaching, you know, people who are coaching people in their businesses and everything like that. I mean, that's that along that look at The Secret, mm-hmm. or the movie The Secret, and with Oprah and everything. So yeah, science, I think, is probably the last place where the companies is coming in and getting through the money to business.
So Brian Greene is a scientist, theoretical, mm-hmm. I don't know what he is, but he's a string theory guy, and I heard him interviewed on CNR the other day,
NPR.
And he was talking about somebody who had quoted that he was a believer in string theory, and he said, I don't believe anything. He said, no, it's a theory, it's a hypothesis. He said, but there's no way to prove mm-hmm. it. But we all, in our theoretical fields, believe that this is a possibility, a probability to answer questions on bringing these things together. So it's exactly what you're saying there. But it's from that relationship, that story thing, rather than the hardcore scientific thing. They'll prove it eventually, but they have to have the thought and the belief first.
So, in a way, you are anticipating the next point. Where are we headed? Can we see the seeds of a synthesis between science and religion? I think we can. That's point E. The first thing that struck Pally was that he realized his scientific research was not, what do I want to say, objective, that the way he really reached his conclusions could be seen to evolve over time in his dreams, and that before he got his ideas, they were in his dreams as images. So he's trying to link up now for the last point that image and science are not two separate things. We think, oh, science is carried out by the analysis of data, which is, of course, not untrue, but what he found is that his dreams were guiding him through that data to form the theory first appearing in his dreams as an image. So he wrote, my dreams have shown me that even the most modern physics also lends itself to the symbolic representation of psychic processes, even down to the last detail. Of course, nothing is further from the thoughts of modern man than the idea of penetrating the secrets of matter in this way. Scientific creative process is just as imagistic as is the artistic creative process. We just haven't explored it because scientists are not used to keeping a record of their dreams and seeing how their ideas first appear as images.
This is a scientific science guy, Carl Popper, and he said, you know, the most important thing is you really have to distinguish how people get their ideas in science and what they do with them once they have them.
Right.
The method is what you do with them once you have them. But he talked about what's the thing you came up with?
Heisenberg.
And in that case, his son had been accused of stealing something from a little historic, and he was so mad at him, but he couldn't imagine his son having done that, and so he couldn't get the image of his son, the son that he had the both on the line at the same time.
Oh.
Then the other famous one is how an atom, the things that go around.
Electron.
So that guy apparently was in a restaurant and either a clown, a guy was sitting the plate on a stick or also the waiter sat the plate down and it's walled.
Oh.
And that's how that came into his mind.
Wow.
So
I
mean, this is about how you get ideas.
Right.
And he talked about the importance of these images and what you do with them. And
right.
People always conflate the two in
their mind. Right, right. Very good point. And that's. That's what he means by the background processes of the psyche. Second quote there, these background processes are not usually perceived, but I believe that they are always present in the unconscious. I myself know them very well from physical dreams, meaning where he could see his dreams paving the way to his physical theories. This language being interpretable both psychologically and physically, so as thus to obtain the psychological correspondence of the physical concepts. That science is just as mythic as myth. It first appears as images. And this next sentence, I thought, really has given me much time to ponder. Maybe the resolution of this science-religion apparent split lies in the recovery of the symbolic attitude. As he writes in the next sentence, I now believe in the possibility of a simultaneous religious and scientific function of the appearance of archetypal symbols. So that by reorienting ourselves towards the symbolic life, practically speaking, we'll realize that images can give rise to scientific theories, images can give rise to religious experience, and it's the same image. And we've got this whole distinction between science and religion wrong, as we don't recognize the imagistic dimension of science, and we literalize the imagistic meanings in religion.
Well, even, you know, the big fundamentalists are religions of the book, of the written word. They're not the religions of pictures. Mm. I mean, you know, they really have shut out pictures. And the more widely they are, the more literal, you know, the exact is only this word and nothing else. So there's, which I guess is the science is the same way. It's only this thing and nothing else. So they're both operating from a similar
He says this is about getting to the archetypal source of religion. Oh, that's the complete title. Archetypal source of science. Sorry, this is about getting the archetypal source of science and thus to a new form of religion. So he's just trying to work with this split in a new way, looking at images as primary, and that scientific thoughts have images behind them, religious thoughts have images behind them, and maybe that's the root to some sort of synthesis. And then he says, my dreams actually make no distinction between laboratory and church. So he can be worshiping in a laboratory, or he can be doing scientific experiments in church. It doesn't seem to make any difference.
So this is what Paul said to you, and what did you say back to Paul?
I'm sure you would say, I agree.
Agree.
Yeah.
Ditto. Yeah.
Ditto. Here, Pally was really helping Jung.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know about the Pally effect? He apparently, if you got near a laboratory, things would blow up.
Mm-hmm.
He was a theoretical physicist, not an experimental. Made a joke, it was a Pally.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess even his train went through like Stuttgart or something when one of his students was doing an experiment, and the experiment blew up just because he was on the train going through.
Oh, so he only blew up if that was physical
evidence.
Apparently.
They knew when he was in the building. They knew when he was.
Oh, they wouldn't let him near the building when they were doing experiments.
Yeah,
that's not a joke.
See what effect things
in very destructively. I don't know what he thought. I think Jung thought, you know, there's a problem there.
There's a problem.
That he had terrific resistances against. Not part of our agenda, but just to mention, you know, what Pally said and what he did were two different things. Mm-hmm. He says these things, but I don't think he lived them. But at least we can have the words, and I think Jung appreciated the words. But he himself, in a way, he would say these things and then act in complete disregard to what he had said. I think that's where the tension came.
Yeah, Persian, was the dream?
Persian, yeah.
That one is because, so it's like his Persian was blowing up the thing.
Absolutely.
To say, look, here, I'm real, I'm here, you know.
And he really wouldn't pay attention, in fact. He would in word over a couple of beers, but over a letter, but he wouldn't publicly. Jane?
Well, I was thinking,
I would put it more to his own personal neurosis.
So, Gary, what do you think was blocking him from allowing this? Because he had an election.
That's a big question.
His career.
I think his career, his vanity, his careerism. He would be not the big shot anymore. He would be laughed at. He'd be a flaky supporter of.
So it wasn't enough. It was still looking at his versus the other, his side versus the other, rather than
for him it was.
Yeah, rather than.
And I guess for us it's a little hard to imagine because today it's not. This is no taboo. You know,
yeah.
Plenty of conferences. But I guess in his time it was taboo.
So that goes back to what you were talking about before, way back here, about that whole thing about the not looking, you know, not looking to the either the scapegoat or
He was major into power.
Yeah, so.
Major into power.
Mm-hmm.
He was an asshole. I mean, to be crude about it, he really was.
But his words
and some of the support he gave Jung, I think, was indispensable to Jung. And Jung put up with the other stuff because he saw the seeds of genius, which unfortunately never flowered. In this regard, they flowered in the strict scientific sense, but they never flowered in this way. And, you know, I think it's a great loss that they didn't. Okay, a couple more points. I hope that I can bring alive for the public the collision between the magic alchemistic and the new in the 17th century scientific way of thinking, a collision that I believe recurs on a higher level in the unconscious of modern man. There was a time in the development of science when the non-rational was not excluded, just at the birth of science in the 17th century. And Pauli felt that in some way we had to go back to that time and recover what we once called superstition, divest it of its hocus pocus, and try to see that it has some element of truth. This whole idea of magical thinking, this other connectedness principle that we're calling synchronicity, was at one time not totally discarded. And the bottom line is, as we've been saying, that we're headed hopefully towards a new worldview. And Pauli characterized that worldview as based on the psychophysical problem. Psychophysical problem is how do we understand the unity between the physical world and the psychological world? How do we understand synchronicity? How do we understand the fact that some diseases can be at least helped, sometimes even cured, through psychotherapy when their meaning is understood? How come others cannot? What is going on in the relationship between, you might say, the mental representation of experience and the body and the physical world? That's the psychophysical problem. That's the great challenge that this material puts out. And Jung says in the same vein, in the unconscious, the third is preparing itself and is already starting to neutralize the tension energy that comes from the opposites. The associations you make with regard to the psychophysical problem are on the right mark as further example of opposites, psyche and body, that are suspended or invalidated in favor of a third. In other words, that there is another point of view trying to be born in this time, one that both can recognize the religious dimension, not literally, but subjectively, one that can recognize that there is this strange link we don't understand between the psyche and the matter, and to come up with a worldview that can contain both at the same time. That, perhaps, is the challenge we're facing today.
Where do you see that happening? Do you see the third showing up?
I think you only see it in dream images that suggest a synthesis. I think you see it in the kind of thing Nancy was talking about, that more theologians are willing to broach a metaphoric understanding of religion. And I think you see it in conferences where scientists are beginning to discuss the kind of thing we're discussing today. It's very much in its beginning stage. Jung felt it would be a 500-year task.
Well, I suppose the whole holistic medicine is moving in that direction. And the interesting thing there, again, is the medical profession moved into that because the individual people were spending so much of their money on it, and the medical profession wanted to get connected. They didn't go there because they thought it was good. They went there because they saw the pot of money, and they wanted access to it. And now, I've actually gotten that in a newsletter from a nursing school at a high-powered hospital telling why. The whole hospital had put in a holistic health clinic because regular people were spending so much of their discretionary dollars on this that the hospital wanted to be able to it was right from the hospital. So, yeah. And now
a little more optimistic angle, I think what the irony is, it's a lot cheaper to do therapy. Like that guy, I saved that guy 2 years worth of his diabetes medication in about 3 months of therapy. So it was just cost effective. That's not the reason I do it, but it really did strike me that that saved him money. Yeah.
Gary, do you think that, thinking about this whole energy thing and shift and tracker site and all the quantum stuff and having a supportive movement, that if we look at it, not what isn't there, but really what is already there, like the holistic field is booming and whatever, that if we start looking at it as what has already occurred rather than what hasn't been there, that in fact can move the momentum forward a little bit more in a more positive trend?
I think this is optimistic. Yeah, Jane?
Well, I was just thinking that
I had a little meditation on the traditional side until I went to the acupuncturist. And the magnetic fields,
I guess, are rearranged. I don't know quite how to explain it. But it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
only 4 or 6,000 years old.
It's
been working that long.
Yeah, I don't know.
Absolutely.
And people swear it's homeopathic medication. And yet what they say, the essence isn't another film, it's the essence of the energy that's in the film, not the substance that you're using. And I find that absolutely fascinating.
That stuff was all around before allopathic medicine came up. So allopathic medicine actually was a son or daughter of acupuncture and homeopathy and all these other practices. And then they kind of fell by the wayside.
Not in Europe, though. Homeopathic is as common.
Yeah, that's true. But they came out of, but it's been kind of ignored on a lot of levels here.
It was said, oh, that doesn't exist. It's a figment of your imagination, kind of thing. And now the third is happening, that these things are now accepted as real.
Well, we also had to believe that it didn't exist when they told us it didn't exist, or else that would have been safe. It would have continued on unless the people, the larger group, had to accept that it didn't exist or it didn't work or it never worked.
Well, I think this is what Gary's saying, is that this stuff is happening on the individual level now first, and then moving from the individual up to the collective, rather than happening on the collective and moving down.
To the both ends?
Yes.
Yeah.
But in other words, a lot of the changes are happening because enough people start doing it individually, and then you get a, you know, you get a hundred monkey kind of thing with enough buildup of energy and acceptance at the individual level, that then that acceptance starts percolating up into the collective.
How about introverts? We have any introverted comments? Come on, silent ones. Point your finger. You, shadow figure, speak. No?
I'll tell you one. Well, sorry about that. She might be caught outside.
Yeah, oh. That one was part of her because the doors are locked.
Spirit matter subset.
It's very nice of you to ask for introverts input. It must be a balance.
Well, then say something.
But do we have any extroverts?
Yeah? Oh my God!
Paul, our man is calling the
Okay. Any other final questions before we wrap it up?
Are you
going to
unplug that bottle of wine?
No, that's for me.
It's actually metaphorical. Push.
Extroverts.
No, yeah, we do not allow false stimulated extroversion. Okay. Thank you. We're done. Oh, well, this is extra. Oh, you want to do that too?
Yeah.
All right, I thought you were done.
Oh, yeah.
Well, these are miscellaneous. I am not addressing myself to the happy possessors of faith, but to those many people for whom the light has gone out, the mystery faded, and God is dead. For most of them, there is no going back, and one does not know either whether going back is always the better way. To gain an understanding of religious matters, probably all that is left us today is the psychological approach. That is why I take these thought forms that have become historically fixed, try to melt them down again, and pour them into molds of immediate experience. The reason I put that in there, he really is talking to non-believers. And it's always important to remember. If you were totally comfortable in your belief, why would you be reading it? So he's speaking to the questioner. I say that because people say, well, you know, he's just trying to take religion away from people, and he's not. He's speaking to those people who've already lost it. And yet saying, don't stop there. I remember when I was in my training, my therapist said, well, what are your religious views? And I said, well, I think I'm an atheist. And she said, well, that's a good place to start. And that's really where he's starting.
That's why it's so important that when you present a way of viewing that is not accepted or that people are dismissing, that you stay in the power of the truth and don't back down. Because I think either you get this or you don't.
That's what he said at the beginning, remember?
But you open with that. When I saw that, I thought it's the same thing. And so, but I think the more that you're willing to own your possibility and just simply say, you know, I can't talk you into it, but just pay attention. Mm-hmm. Notice what you notice. I think that's the way that people will begin, because gaps open all the time into people's experience. Mm-hmm. Open up as fast as they can. And so I think this is just an invitation to hold the gap open long enough to look. And then remember, remember when you're fit or skinny fit or whatever. But that's not always easy to do.
I love this next quote. Ed Andrews says it point blank. Of course, if one is not contained in a particular dogmatic creed, then that opens up the whole opportunity for the experience of the reality of the psyche. Does that make sense? That's not being identified with the tradition any longer. That's the fish getting out of the water. And we find not a few people who try to stay in that borderline interim position and have the best of both worlds. they dabble with psychology and still think they don't have to relinquish the comfort that the religious containment offers. But that's compartment psychology, in which the right hand is not allowed to know what the left is doing. If analysis is going to have any real effect, those two sides have to be introduced to each other, and then, as Jung says, the person is in the right. Where you see that is, you know, is people are in sort of a reductive Freudian psychology, which excludes any spirit. And then they go to church. So they get their psychology here and their spirit here. And what we've said is, you know, that is based on an old worldview. There's only your experience. And if you are in a relationship to your experience, you don't need that church. And you don't accept an atheistic psychology, because your experience is putting demands to you whose fulfillment gives you the sense of the spiritual life.
Which always cracks me up when you give that example of Catholics all the way through church, and then when they start having their own experiences, they dream of
that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I've seen that several times.
Unbelievable.
Did you follow that?
Yeah. No, they dream of a mass. They dream about being in a mass. I don't know if they dream in a part of the mass.
They suffer from the fact that they can't go to mass anymore. They can't stomach the church; it makes them sick. Yet they literally long for the mass like you long for a lover, and they're sad. And when they're able to take up their individuation process and see what work is meant for them, and they participate in that life, that's the incarnation, you see. They get the image from their dreams of who they are, then they realize that in time and space, then they dream during the Mass, and then they're satisfied. As if to say the Mass has become an inner dimension of the way you live in the outer world. It's no longer something you do in church. But you can't get there until you have lost faith in the Mass. He says again, there's no such thing as depth psychology as long as one is contained in the church. As long as the collective unconscious is bound, so to speak, to the symbolism of a concrete, particular religious dogmatic structure, there's no possibility of experiencing it empirically and individually. So you're a fish in the water. So there's no depth psychology for those who are contained within a specific religious creed, because there's no need for it. Depth psychology has been born in the modern age because we need it. We've got to have it. And then, just by contrast, a person who I'm sure is a good analyst, I just don't care for the way she deals with this issue of religion and psychology, and she's got a position of freshership at Union Theological Seminary in New York in Ulanoff. She writes in complete contradiction, as a contrast to the above quote, I include the following, and that's me. Now here comes her quote. The question of the relation of depth psychology and theology must include the perception that there is no basis for conflict or mutual negation because there is no precise common ground. So what could be further from the truth? That is a professor of theology at Union Theological Seminary, who's also a Jungian analyst. Their respective points of view shape their methods, attitude, tasks, materials, and images of truth differently. See, that's church dabbling and then dabbling with psychology.
Rather, so, Gary, is there no place that you can dabble with both and honor both?
No.
So there's never, it's not going to come together.
It has come together. It's called Jungian psychology.
Yeah, okay.
In which we find our religious life consists in fulfilling the meaning of our imagery. And when we do that, we're living the Mass.
Okay, but can you take it back into the Mass then?
I don't know.
It's interesting.
It's a good question. Maybe. I think the great danger is, as soon as you take it back, that you're there as a substitute for your own development. I think it is possible that a community of people living their own process could constitute a second church, another church. I think that is possible. Mm-hmm. I don't see it happening, but I think it's possible. Introverts speak. Yes?
I was just thinking about this ritual that Susan Bettis had called together over the years, so that's, I mean, it's a fortunate, but that could be, again, it is probably for people who have to participate all the time, I think.
It's speaking for myself, that it's step, but it's not one step. Because I actually have had the math dream after several years of analysis, and it was really only after that I didn't have that long in that hole to go back to try to find some kind of organized house, cathedral, whatever, and go to. I didn't do anything because it was something evil. Brought me closer to God than the church, than the self. Which is actually an experience I have when I'm 7 years old trying to come to.
What was the experience? Do you want to start here?
No, I was in church with my mother. My mother was a devout Catholic till the day she died, and I had this experience which I can't even to this day verbalize, but I was something very profound happened. And I explain it now as between me and God. Mm-hmm. And it was between my first union and my
he confirmed it, and he just went, oh,
yeah. I thought, buddy, that's not it, you know.
You should have whacked me in the face.
No initiation.
The same experience that I had 2 years before, a year before, whatever it was.
Yeah, it was a wake-up call.
Right. And I was really, never had the same relationship with the church from that moment on. But it took me until I was 23 years old before I could even not go.
Did you try to share that with anybody? What you experienced? Did you tell
anybody?
And they were confused?
Well, not as a child. No.
You can't really explain a visceral experience.
It's not a concept.
Did you go and gone back to them?
Oh, I tried for years.
But how about the lady since you found a dual center in your own space outside of the church? I just wondered if you had an experience, a different experience.
Another thing that helped me with closure was through a ritual group, I met this woman who chose to stay in the church and work with whatever it was to work with them. So I said, you know, I really miss going to community. There is that ritual that really, really touches me. And she said, I'm one of the, whatever, Eucharistic ministers going to be, host at Christmas morning. Why don't you come?
Because I was going to be a priest.
Thanks for stopping on, right?
Anything else? I will say we're finished. Thank you.